Listeners at Irregular Hours, episode 127 for September 1st, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here at the end of our, I guess we could say, first book club, where we have read through The Devil in the White City, the 2003 book from Eric Larson, the New York Times bestseller, about the wonderful World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, and the terrible American serial killer who found so many victims in that World's Fair.
And planned them out. That's the problem. Not only did he find them, he had set up a trap to get them there. Mm.
And here,
or take advantage of it.
And here in part four, we have Cruelty Revealed is the title. This is a mad dash to the finish for this murder investigation. We get a fast forward 2 years to the year 1895, and we're introduced to our detective character, Frank Geyer, in this part.
And it was kind of interesting at the very end of the novel to get this whole new character and to actually get focalization through that character. So you get his perspective. Yeah. So after spending so much time with the architect, the serial killer, and now suddenly this private detective, was kind of an interesting twist.
It's an interesting narrative device, because what Eric Larson did was do alternative chapters, one about the fair and then one about the serial killer, until part four, where the fair is over and it's barely even mentioned in part four. This is all changing that focus to Detective Geyer and his search for this murderer.
I tend to like that a lot. This idea, we get a little bit about how the planning of the fair and the building of the fair and execution of the fair. And then every other chapter, we're getting a little bit about we learn a little bit about H.H. Holmes, we learn about the planning of his building, and then the execution of his plans.
Boy, execution's probably the wrong word for a serial killer. Okay, thanks, Chip.
You know Chip did that on purpose.
I know he did.
Now, let me ask you guys, as we now have completed this book, can I ask, what was your favorite part? What do you think is the strength of this novel for you? And Steve, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I really enjoy this book. I really find this method of narrative so effective. This is a nonfiction book that adds so much emotion to the documents that are used as reference. The research that Eric Larson did, he added emotion to these characters, and we, the reader, get to experience that from a distance. This is definitely not narrative structure like a fiction would be, but we get those feelings, and I love the writing here.
I think we all enjoyed that as we've talked it through. Can you tell me which part you found that you were like the most engaged with emotionally? Because I'll just tell you guys, to me, it was as we were approaching the fair and there was like 1 month left and you had 10,000 workers and would you be able to get it done? Like that idea. And maybe it's because, I mean, as a person who's always way overcommitted in time, I'm constantly like, will I meet this deadline or not? I don't think I will. Oh my goodness. And working in collaborative teams of trying to meet absolutely crazy deadlines. I thought he captured that super well. And as a writer, I'm like, oh yeah, he knows that emotion deeply.
And the truth of that is that you have to have a leader who does have a vision, but also recognizes there's going to be all these setbacks along the way, which he experiences. And there's faith that it's going to be done in time to get everything started. And so it wasn't perfect when it opened, but over the course of the time, they got what they could get done.
And they lost a ton of money because they didn't make the deadline, which I thought was like, you kind of, that's the reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Pam? What was your favorite part?
So I really liked how he uses juxtaposition as a way of understanding history. Because, of course, when we think about history, it's just one story, right? We can never fully understand our past because we really only have, to understand the past, we only have the documents that we're left with, right? And so then we don't actually get individual people's experiences. You get the whole like history is written by the victors. I mean, that's a true thing. And here I thought that he did a really nice job of doing that juxtaposition between the architect, where we have a ton of documentation of what Daniel Burnham was doing, who he was working with, how he was making things happen. And then this much, much more speculative piece about Holmes, because I think there's far less documentation there. And the documentation that exists is highly questionable. So
are you suggesting his Holmes memoir is not something that we can take as truth?
Oh, I want to talk about Holmes. but I think that notion of juxtaposition, of not just letting official documents stand, but of trying to add in, you know, well-considered, well-researched, but nonetheless speculative stories that go around major events. It's a really effective historiographical tool that sort of highlights that history can never be fully known.
Well, and in fact, there is that part where our writer, Larson, has to, you know, create what really happened during those murders. When I say what really happened, he has to use his imagination along with the document to kind of piece together and then create the scenes.
Right.
And Chip, is that your favorite part of this reading?
Oh, no. That was scary, Steve. my favorite part is that this is, it's a true story. So it's nonfiction that reads like fiction. This is the amount of research that Larson did. He wanted to write a book. He didn't have a subject yet, but he ran across this and said, oh, well, I'll start putting together some research. And then it sparked him to take the time that he's putting together this and then write a book about it. And I really like the idea of, because there are times in life where you find that, oh, I've got interest in this. So Steve, you go, I love time travel. And all of a sudden you read a lot about it, and then you taking that research and then putting together a book so you can share it with another, that's really lovely. I mean, it's really is, it's work, but it's a work of love. It's a labor of love.
So what do you think were some of I don't want to use the word weaknesses here, Pam, but shortcomings of Larson's writing?
Well, so I'll just start, and I said this right from day one. This is just me. I don't love the idea of fetishizing actual murders. And I did think that Larson got really close to doing that on a few occasions. And I think we talked a little bit when he was like, oh yeah, I'm sure like Holmes would have had this whole array of, you know, horrifying tools, and the murder victim's heart would have been pounding, and mm-hmm. he would have been all aroused. And I'm like, ew, this is a real murder. And I mean, in part four, I didn't love the way that he talked about the murder of the children. I guess mm-hmm. to me, that was tough. But now that's not a diss on Larson. That's just something, that's the reason I don't usually read true crime.
So, no, I'm going to go from memory. But I do know that the Eric Larson was inspired, as he was doing his research, he looked at Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. Mm-hmm. And if I remember, this is what my speculation, if I remember properly, I don't think Capote ever wrote another book after that. I think he wrote short stories, but it was very, very difficult on him. And one of the complaints Larson said about In Cold Blood is that he really wished that Capote would have left his notes around so you could follow what was Capote putting in there and what was his research and his interviews with these murderers. So I think that there were some parts of that. This idea of fetishizing the murders, I can totally get it. But as you're building it up, there is a box, a trunk, the kids are put in it, and there's the speculation that they were gassed, and there's a hole, they find a hole in the box. That is horrifying. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, how do you address stuff like that? How do you address that it wasn't that? I don't think there's a humane way to address murders. I mean, certainly. I mean, the term is there's you were certainly these are they were planned and they were certainly brutal in the sense that they happened.
So what do you see as the weakness of this book, if anything?
I would have liked part four to be a little longer. I think we could have learned a little bit more about the number of victims, because we get Holmes, as we learn in part four, toys with family members, the children he was keeping and the parents were just, they were around the corner. They certainly weren't very far away, and they were all under distress. They were being moved from one city to another. They're being moved around the cities when they got there. He certainly he tortured these people. Mm-hmm. And not that I want to know more about the torture.
And you would like more of that, Chip? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not interested in knowing more, but the deal was that wasn't it. We don't know if he killed 20 people or 200. And that's what we don't get is the scope of the number of people he killed. We get a smattering of this and kind of a talk about that he killed a lot of people, but we don't know exactly how many. And I think that, you know, if we know, go back to Jack the Ripper, who was at 5 victims, this mm-hmm. is certainly on a whole different scale.
And when you say we don't know, it is history that does not know how many victims Holmes had. He was convicted of, I believe the number is 9 murders, but there is a possibility that he was responsible for those 200. I don't think that that's a weakness in the writing here, Chip. I really appreciate that Larson didn't give us the mind of this murderer, the why he did this, and we never get that perspective. I enjoy this story because it doesn't have a lot of gruesome parts. Part four certainly has a lot of details, but we don't get the same level of gratuitous violence that we get in the story of Jack the Ripper, with the pictures and the details of these murders.
We do get what Geyer was finding, though.
Mm-hmm.
And we also get how difficult it was to even uncover it.
Mm-hmm.
You get to a town and basically you're looking around, interviewing people.
Yeah, and that was one thing that I found really interesting. What do you think for you guys was the impact of bringing in that third main character just in part four, Geyer the detective, and having him seeing it through his perspective and the sort of, I don't want to say tedious, but yeah, the sort of tedious going around to hotel after hotel, trying to figure out where Holmes had been, looking through all those hotel registers, looking out for Holmes's distinctive handwriting because he was using an alias. And so two questions about Geyer, like, what do you think is the impact of having him be your final perspective? And then also, what about the fact that he's a private rather than a public detective? I mean, Holmes was caught because of insurance fraud, not because of murder.
Because he had so many cases of insurance fraud. That's one thing that was brought to us in the first beginnings mm-hmm. of this character, was he figured out how to put life insurance policies onto people and then to kill them, like, immediately after they had this insurance policy. So, yes, the financial records certainly damned him to being caught more than the disappearances, because, as Larson said over and over again, disappearing was a hobby of people in this time. They just disappeared. They were just gone. But the financial records got him.
Holmes is a good example of just disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
he was able.
He changed aliases. I mean, he had aliases.
And wound up in Toronto at one point. I mean, this is an international incident here in part four.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it was interesting from Geyer's perspective. It was so difficult to do the research in Toronto, a city that he didn't know, but also a much, much larger city than the smaller places that Holmes had initially taken the Pitzel kids. And so it wasn't a matter of just checking out a small number of hotels. It was just a huge enterprise to try to figure out where they'd been.
And sure. The history here of this idea that he took these kids and had their mother and had three different hotel rooms, sometimes in the same hotel, and he's moving these people around in a staggering, amazing way. It's fascinating at the same time that it's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I found it interesting that I felt like I didn't really get to know Geyer that well. And this, Chip, goes back to, I'm sorry, I was sort of teasing you like, oh, you wanted to see more torture? But I wouldn't have minded getting to know the detective a little bit better. Maybe that's part of what part four, like, we get this idea like, oh, there's this whole new character, although he's not like a charming blue-eyed boy like our architect and our serial killer, but he's a character. But mm-hmm. We see his work more than we see him as a person.
And without talking too much about our next book, I think that we're using a very similar structure, but we're going to get to know the Geyer character okay. more because you're right. You're looking through the eyes of a person who's trying to piece, going through records saying, okay, so where was this person? Oh my goodness, there's more than one family here. I'm sorry, more than one group here. They don't know that they're around each other. But Holmes has basically created this spider web and moving this group around the country and, ultimately with Toronto thrown in for good measure.
Well, and this brings us to the representations of crime, right? Because you can represent, there's three characters in any kind of crime. You have a victim, a murderer, and a detective, right? And the detective sort of stands in for us, the reader, in a way. And so how you represent that is totally different in a true crime story than a mm-hmm. story. And we as readers probably have our own favorite way of seeing it. I mean, we don't want to see it through the perspective of the victim, although that's how thrillers are told, right? So thrillers are told from the perspective of the victim who's mm-hmm. trying to escape this horrible fate. Mm-hmm. True crime or crime fiction is told through the perspective of the murderer. And then detective fiction, of course, from the person putting it all together who represents.
So which one's your favorite, Pam?
Steve, I told you we'd learn something. I told you we'd learn something.
From the detective fiction expert from the University of Connecticut? Yeah, Chip, I think maybe she likes the detective's perspective the best.
Well, maybe, and I see that. But that's the thing that, like, so I do agree with Chip that it would have been nice to get a little bit more of Geyer's work, especially that I have to say, I think it was pretty impressive work to actually track down the bodies in this Toronto. In this Toronto Inn. I mean, I think that was pretty impressive. That wasn't easily done.
Yeah, that was not my favorite scene though. Digging up the dirt in the cellar. Nope. I'm out punching out. Nope.
Almost a Sherlock Holmes type of reveal there. And now I'm going to be digging.
I don't disagree with you. There was certainly a, and here's the reveal. But at the same time, boy, that's a gruesome description of the decay of these children. And
the mother.
The mother who kept being almost on the edge of fainting. They had to keep giving her smelling salts and brandy. Did you see that?
As people do in the century, my friends. We very well know from
We've
our
learned that.
20 odd days with Sherlock Holmes. So now, stepping back a little bit from the situation of the murder, since I keep calling it a novel, you guys, just mm-hmm. like it feels like fiction. Since most of this book does focus on the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893, what did you guys think? What do you see as the effect of that event on the identity of Chicago, which you guys have an intimate knowledge of, and on like American identity writ large? What did Larson sort of reveal about this event that really continues to shape American and Chicago identity.
I said it from the very beginning, the World's Columbian Exposition is a pivotal moment in Chicago's history. It is that moment that put Chicago on the map. The idea of the Ferris wheel, this enormous structure that was the identity of this fair, just like the Eiffel Tower was the identity of the Paris World's Fair. All of the things that were shown off at this fair are now historic parts that we have built upon for the last 130 years. This is the basis of so many different things. And Chicago, the identity of Chicago here, being able to come together to have 10,000, maybe even 20,000 men working on this project, that is part of Chicago's identity and keeps going. We are the working area. We get things done.
Certainly, you touched on the scale of the event and sort of what it meant for Chicago, because Chicago worked very hard to be the second largest city in the United States over because of annexation, overtook Philadelphia to become the second largest population in the world, wanted to establish itself as a world city. Certainly did that. And then it also sort of created the identity on how the city would develop itself. So we talk a lot about the architecture. We talk a lot about, and architecture is very important to Chicago, even though it's criticized afterwards, setting back architecture for many years because of the designs they use. But landscaping and green spaces, I mean, from Lakeshore Drive, as far as the parks that are against the lake, that'll eventually be put there, to those big open areas that we have all over Chicago land, it certainly helped define this city.
And I guess I kind of wanted to jump into and think about the way that he juxtaposes the World's Fair with the serial killer's story, I think also plays into this. And I think the Ferris wheel is such an amazing symbol of this moment. So first of all, it leads to, there's something so theatrical about the Ferris wheel, right? About how it's so gigantic too. This is not like the kind of Ferris wheel we're used to, right? This is an absolutely enormous Ferris wheel with what, how many people were in each?
Was it 60 people per car?
That's what I'm picturing too. So it's just
enormous. Train car size cars.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there was a full band in one of the cars, but yeah. That your job was to play.
Exactly. But it feels to me like even just like the smaller Ferris wheels that we've been at with every fair since, I shouldn't say every fair since then, but the Ferris wheel is
pretty close.
Right. I mean, it's a symbol of the fair. I think the Ferris wheel is all about perspective, right? It allows a common person, an everyday person, to walk into this space, to pay a fairly affordable amount of money, and to suddenly be able to see the world from this totally new perspective, from way, way, way above.
What a great word. You should say that word all the time.
Thank you, Steve. But I want also to think about when you get to the top of the Ferris wheel and it stops to let someone out at the bottom, you get this feeling of vertigo, right? Like, even if you don't have a problem with heights, and I love heights, but the one place where I'm like, ooh, is at the top of a Ferris wheel, because you're like moving a little bit, there's wind, you have this crazy perspective that's not part of your everyday life. And even though you know you're not going to fall, and these guys did not know they're not going to fall because this Ferris wheel had not been very well tested, you get that feeling of like, I could fall, but also that vertiginous feeling of I could jump, right? It puts you in this very, very weird space. And I think that Larson, without stating it, sort of notes that as a comparison to the serial killer. Because, of course, our taboo against killing is super, super strong. And there are tons and tons of psych experiments where, I mean, and even like experiments of soldiers, you tell people to kill someone, it's not easy to do. You have to work very, very, very hard to get past our natural tendency not to kill each other. And so that idea of the serial killer sort of standing on the precipice and like doing it, right? So it feels to me like the Ferris wheel and the mass murder they're both sort of these very, they split your perspective apart. They are thinking outside of the box, both of them.
I'm going to jump on this because I think you hit something that's pretty interesting. Because in this book, we got the idea of the Ferris wheel presented to us. And when I see a picture of a Ferris wheel, I don't think it's very special. I just see it's a Ferris wheel. But this was when it was introduced. And so something that is so common now was such a novelty at that point, and certainly a game changer. But we got from the idea to where it was being built, and it wasn't quite ready, to when it was fully completed. Eventually, they go into the part where it gets moved and it can't really make its money for it. And then it gets moved again. Was it down to New Orleans or something? Maybe Louisiana? Anyway, eventually it's just scrap metal. So this thing that is so novel and new, such a game changer, such a part of our psyche of carnivals and
Americana.
And eventually is useless. And
it's just scrap metal.
Returned to dust. Yeah. And that was a very relatively short time.
What a strong symbol that is.
Yeah. I like that a lot. And so as we think about the Ferris wheel, I'm going to ask a question that seems not very nice. But as we think about the Ferris wheel as a piece of Americana, as a type of, as a figure for American identity, where do you think the serial killer fits into American national identity or American lore? Like, what do you think the importance of the serial killer is in terms of how we understand our nation?
Well, I'm going to bring it to Chicago first. Because because if I said, oh, Chicago, and I said Al Capone, everybody would go, I know exactly who that guy is. Mm-hmm. But if I said H.H. Holmes, there may be a person. Mm-hmm. There may be a couple.
Yeah. So he's kind of lost to history.
He is. In fact, that's the interesting part of this is this guy that was incredibly cruel. Certainly, we should all look at his name and go, oh my goodness, what a madman he was. We don't really know who he is, but we know so many other colorful characters around him.
He was so charming. He was able to talk his way out of and into so many situations in this book that he's lost to history because his fame is pretty thin, despite the fact that he might be responsible for up to 200 murders.
If Jack the Ripper is the devil, you know, H.H. Holmes is like 10 times him.
I wonder how much of it that is because he got caught, because there was a trial, where Jack the Ripper is a mystery, is an enigma, and I wonder what degree that plays into it.
I think that's a really, really important point. And I hate to say this, but I also think that the modus operandi is part of it too. That, I mean, Jack the Ripper's crimes were so gory and visceral, whereas Holmes used a number of different forms of killing. And, you know, there was a quote that I wanted to bring up from the Larson book that compares the two men. He says, Holmes did not kill face to face as Jack the Ripper had done, gorging himself on warmth and viscera. Thanks, Larson. Mm. He did like proximity. He liked being near enough to hear the approach of death and the rising panic of his victims. This was when his quest for possession entered its most satisfying phase. And then Larson goes through to say he uses a bunch of different methods, chloroform, gas, suffocation. Larson goes back, the choice was his, a measure of his power. The subsequent articulation by his very talented friend Chapel constituted the final phase of acquisition, the triumphal phase. And this brings us back to the fact that he would send a body to his friend Frank Chapel, who would then articulate the body, leaving it as a skeleton. And so I think that part of what happens here is that Holmes's method, and especially it wasn't revealed as it was happening, right? So with the Jack the Ripper murders, all of London was like, there's a serial killer among us. what are we going to do? Like, you know, he seems to be killing prostitutes right now, but no one is safe. Mm-hmm. With Holmes, the great reveal doesn't happen until 2 years after.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So the fear is certainly not a part of it at that point. So that is right. Part of why most people have not heard of this serial killer.
So you could have lived in Chicago in the 1890s, and then you could have read this story that some bodies were found in Toronto, where you've mm-hmm. never been, and it was a guy from Chicago who did it. How crazy, right? Like, it doesn't have that same immediacy. And also, when you think about what Jack the Ripper and Holmes wrote, they're very, very different. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether Jack the Ripper, whoever Jack the Ripper was, actually wrote the notes to the newspapers. I mean, we'll get into that with our next book, my friends. But that really did, there was this notion of like the killer speaking to the public through the media. Whereas Holmes, he wrote this. I mean, I've never heard of Holmes's memoir. I've certainly never read it. I'm not going to go order it on microfilm, which is presumably how you would get it today. But, I mean, Holmes wrote this memoir that was super rhetorical and trying to be like, oh, I might have committed a little insurance fraud here and there, but I never killed anyone. That's just not who I am. And so...
Charming inaccuracies.
He's out there trying to find the real killers. He's on the golf course.
Exactly, Steve. That was the best part, right? And the real problem with convicting me of these terrible crimes is you'll never find out who really did it. And everyone's like, no, we already know who really did it.
So, it was Hatch. Hatch did it.
So epistemologically, in terms of like, what do we know? How do we know it? Jack the Ripper is this open mystery that will always be an open mystery. We're never going to solve that one, my friends, if we haven't by now, and which therefore makes it so appealing to people.
Steve, Pam doesn't believe in time travel. I'm sorry.
Oh, so that would solve it, because the doctor certainly caught Jack the Ripper. Madame Vastra actually caught him and ate him in an episode of Doctor Who, just so you know. So don't worry about Jack the Ripper. He's been taken care of. One of our listeners, Magda, actually theorizes that it is possible that the timelines line up just right, that this same human being could have been in London in those years before this and could have been Jack the Ripper and then came to Chicago and became H.H. Holmes. Dun, dun, dun.
I think that's been speculated many times, and I think it also has been disproved.
Probably.
I think the MO was just way too wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
yeah,
but that certainly is. I mean, that would make a great story, and that's mm-hmm. certainly. I mean, I guess there is a possibility of things like that. That's pretty awesome.
I'm sure there's several pastiches of that vocabulary.
Now, can I go? You know me. Can I go to the ending of part four?
Yeah,
it's like a cement block. You can hit me with it.
So, at the ending of part four, we get one of the most surprising and perhaps dismaying revelations was that Chicago's chief of police, in his prior legal career, had represented Holmes in a dozen routine commercial lawsuits. The Chicago Times-Herald took the broad view and said of Holmes, quote, he is a prodigy of wickedness, a human demon, a being so unthinkable that no novelist would dare to invent such a character. The story, too, tends to illustrate the end of the century. End of part four. Now, there's so many things in that I find fascinating. First of all, that casual corruption, right? Of like the Chicago chief of police.
Are you welcome suggesting, to Chicago, Pam.
Are you suggesting that there could possibly be even a chance that there could be ever any corruption
on your mind, in my the police force
of Chicago? That is, let me just say that we back the blue here.
The governor and the mayor, on the other hand, they might sometimes in the history of Chicago have ties to certain people. An alderman of Chicago sometimes have alternative motives to their choices.
There was a joke. I want to say it was maybe a year ago. We were talking about Blagojevich getting out of jail. And it was like the first time in like 20 years that there wasn't a governor in prison here in Illinois. former governor.
Welcome to Illinois, where the governors make our license plates. Yes. Yeah.
But I think, too, that this notion that the story of a serial killer illustrates the end of the 19th century, that's a fascinating thought. And it's a fascinating place to sort of leave this portion of the story. This idea that we've become so efficient by the end of the 19th century with all of the new, you know, new industrial moves that serial killing, that murderers are no longer, you know, caught up in their passions or have simple motives. There's this new motive for murder, which is completely incomprehensible. Right. And I like that Larson does not try to give us a motive for Holmes's work, because I think you can't. I think that's the whole point of it. You can't.
I agree.
You can't understand a person like Holmes. And honestly, maybe you shouldn't even try. It's just one of those. It's one of those things.
And there was a huge desire to study his brain, just to study him. And Holmes was very explicit on what should be done to his body once he passed. They put him in with a cement coffin, only to be taken to a graveyard and placed into another cement hole.
Grave, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, the idea, it would be a lot of effort if you had to get to him.
Yeah, and he did that on purpose. He did not want his body to be studied. He certainly made a study of humanity in his way, and he did not want to be a victim of that in his mind. That was a very interesting part of the history of this.
Well, yeah, and isn't it interesting to return to the Olympic, right? So we end this book on the Titanic's sister ship, just as we began it. And I think it's interesting. So we end with Burnham and he's writing in his diary. So we get a lot, like in this part four and epilogue, we see Holmes writing his memoir. We see the detective Geiger writing his memoir. And then we see Burnham writing in his diary. So I think that Larson is trying to remind us and pull us back at the end. Oh, this is all nonfiction, you guys. I read all those documents. I did the work for you. I've told you a story that read like a novel, which makes it more fun, but I did do the work. And then he ends up a very whimsical way that's very very focused on the senses, actually. So he talks about where everyone's buried, right? So Burnham lived only 47 more days after the Titanic. He talks about many, many of the characters that he's talked about. John Root lies nearby, as do the Palmers, Lewis Sullivan, Mayor Harrison, Marshall Field, Philip Armour, and so many others in vaults and tombs that vary from the simple to the grand. Potter and Bertha still dominate things, as if stature mattered even in death. They occupy a massive acropolis with 15 giant columns atop the only high ground overlooking the pond. The others cluster around. On a crystalline fall day, you can almost hear the tinkle of fine crystal, the rustle of silk and wood, almost smell the expensive cigars. So from going through all of these ideas and thoughts, we end up with this fall day where you can actually hear things, smell things, see things. And so he's just trying to sort of, again, with a perspective, pulling us back, looking at the graveyard and thinking, wow, this is what remains of all of these people, is their graves, but it's also the story.
So in the end, there's death.
We're all stories. We're all stories in the end, Chip. We're all memories for somebody.
Sheesh. So dark.
It's a murder. I hope everybody's enjoyed all of this. I hope that you have enjoyed this book. I literally have never heard anybody review this book and say that they did not like Eric Larson's writing here.
In fact, everyone who has commented on Facebook or to me live, they have all said they've read it, they've loved it. And it's a good book. It's a good book to pick for a book club.
It really was. I'm glad that we chose this one as our first book to read for our new book club, Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. This was my choice. I was the one who brought this one to the book club. So, Chip, it's your turn. What's our next book club assignment?
So we're going to read Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell's From Hell about Jack the Ripper.
Great.
So, murder.
He loves nothing more than five viscera.
He was no H.H. Holmes, that's what I'll tell you.
But you know what was missing from this book was the pictures.
That's right. This is, in fact, when Road to Perdition came out as a movie and everybody raved about it, they went to get the novel and they found out it was a graphic novel. Many people balked at it, you know, being worthy of such a good movie. From Hell is a bad movie, but this work, and I think what we're going to enjoy most about it is that Alan Moore did a lot of research on this and they created a story. So where this is truth that was that reads like it's a novel, this next one is a novel that's based off truth. And I think that there's something to be said there, and something that we will enjoy as we sort of continue to explore, I don't know, these 1880s, 1890s, certainly a very interesting period of time.
Pam, you should study the 1890s more in your life.
Yeah, I was going to say something about
that's
that.
That's a great suggestion.
It's pretty much all you study, isn't it?
No.
Okay, sure. All I read is time travel.
But this is going to be really fun now. I've never read this book. I'm really looking forward to it. It's been on to read list for a while. And I'm also really looking forward to thinking about, you know, what it says in terms of all of these conversations we've been having about detectives and criminals and victims and the late 19th century, but also how the pictures work. I just feel like, I mean, graphic novels are such a fascinating place to look at how language works and how visuals and linguistics work together. So I'm really excited about this one.
And so for those who are not familiar with Alan Moore, Alan Moore is very specific with the artist on where things should be. So he uses a lot of cues, and those pictures really could matter a lot. In addition to that, there is his notes that are in the back of at least the paper version. And it is suggested that you, if you're having a difficult time following a character, following what's going on, check those notes out. Usually there's something in there that could give you a better clue.
All right, so your reading assignment for next week, next Tuesday, we are reading the first four chapters of From Hell by Alan Moore. That's pages 1 through 123. So you only have 123 pages to read, but it's a graphic novel, and maybe one of our conversations will be how we read this and how it's different from paragraph form. This genre certainly will draw us in, I think.
I was going to say, Pam has gotten the paper version, and you also can get the Comixology version. You can get that either on a Kindle or through Comixology.com.
And also, you can check your local library, because I got mine from the local library.
Are you able to read picture by picture, or are you reading page by page?
Picture by picture.
Okay.
That's the Comixology style, which I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve and Pam.
What do you think, Pam?
I'm in.
All right. From Hell, another gruesome murder story. That's
from the late 19th century. That's
from
our
the thing. Late 19th century. Oh, boy. I hope everybody out there is with us. I hope you're going out and finding a copy of this book and reading along with us. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. Our email is sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. And we're going to get more serial killers. Good job, everybody. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenthrush.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
See you in the future.